It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about, lots in the news, files, papers, havens, all kinds of insanity, all kinds of things we already knew. This is the part that gets me. Big stories, big millions of documents being released. And it's all stuff that, well, sadly, we've known for a very long time. So going to get into a lot of that today. But first, before I get into it, good news for the workers who make magic, the folks who make our movies and our television programs and all of the things that we consume in the big screens and little screens. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, IATSE, their members voted overwhelmingly. 98% of the members who voted and 90% of the members actually voted. An amazing thing to authorize a strike to say, look, we want better wages, hours, conditions. We demand dignity, respect, and more importantly, conditions. It's the conditions. Some of the horror stories that we've heard as people have returned back to making movies. They don't want to go back to working 14, 16, 20-hour days. They don't want to be driving home tired and smashing into things anymore. They've had enough. And to have that kind of turnout, when you've got 90% of the membership and 98% of those people voting to say, yep, we've got to do something, this a wake-up call. Now, this strike could happen any day. Some 60,000 people, 150,000 people across the globe could put down their cameras, put down their pens and computers and all of the things that they do to make the magic, and all that stops. And to me, this is a big message moment for other people who are in similar situations. Because look, we're told there's a labor shortage. There's no labor shortage. The crisis is there are too many crummy jobs. The reason that we've got so many unopened positions is people just don't want to do it for the wages and the conditions under which you toil. Are you surprised that people don't want to be bus drivers working 3 hours in the morning and coming back later in the day and working a couple hours? No, they want jobs. They want careers. They want something for the future. So not surprising to me, but going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Like I said, could happen any day. But let's get into the ballots and the papers and the files. Facebook was down all day today. And I didn't miss it one bit because I don't use Facebook. Because the reality is, and we've been talking about this for years, Facebook is one of the worst of social media platforms. And if you watch the 60-minute interview with the quote unquote, with the whistleblower, and it's a shame that this woman has to be titled a whistleblower, this Frances Haugen, who was somebody who was brought in to clean up the mess, what we found out was what we already knew. Facebook is the worst of the worst. Their algorithm intentionally shows people things that are going to make them angry. It's not about cat and puppy videos. No, it's about what's going to keep your eyeballs on the screen. And we've known this for a very long time. This is not new. This is my problem with everything here. None of this stuff is new. We know it. The problem is it's just so enormous that most of us are like, well, we can't change it. Let's be angry about something that maybe we have some control over. This is a problem here. And this woman's interview, and I give her credit for coming out. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens to this poor woman. But she was right. Well, look, the algorithm is set up to keep feeding you the hate. Back to the George Orwell 1984, the 2 minutes hate. You got to get your 2 minutes hate in 24/7 because it keeps you engaged. It keeps you consuming because you're looking for the next fix of hatred and the next fix of anger. And Facebook is there to make sure that they do it. Now, Hagen said in the interview, I've seen a bunch of social media networks, and it was substantially worse at Facebook than anything I've ever seen before. And you go, yeah, Facebook's bad, which is why I stopped using it years ago. The kind of data that they collect, the kind of things that they continue to send, it wasn't good for me. It was, and it's not. It's not good for anyone. It did not foster discussion or debate. It simply kept putting things in front of me that was, you know, to make me angry. And I'm like, I got enough of that on my own. And what we found out is a couple other things. For instance, you know, they had a civic integrity unit up until the election in 2022, around 2020, and they dissolved it after the election. And of course, before the insurrection on January 6th. And you go, gee, I wonder if that could have, helped. It's quite remarkable. But as this woman was pointing out, that, you know, the research that was out there is only a small percentage of the hatred and the kind of things that we want off of there ever get off. There's so much, because the whole platform is based on just that. And it's a learned response. It's a Pavlovian response. If you say something nice, it goes nowhere. Nobody sees it. You say something mean, hateful, and angry, it gets multiple views, and there are comments, and there's all kind of engagement, and people who need to feel that validation. That's a drug, man. And they keep going, and they keep going. And then it's just, how far can we go? How extreme can we go? You know, there was one point where she's talking about in Europe, for instance, that, you know, the political parties, I guess, ran negative ads just to get people on Facebook to look at them. So you're not even talking about your message anymore. You're talking about how horrible the other guy is. And I see this in various campaigns. It's no longer about, hey, vote for us because we're going to blah, 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 blah. It's, don't vote for him because he's horrible. And that ad gets retweeted, because maybe it's who we are. I don't know. But it's really horrible for us. Now, what I found interesting in this woman's interview is how she tried to defend Zuckerberg and the people at Facebook. Is, well, you know, they're not bad people. They just have, you know, misaligned incentives. You know, money. Because who would have known that Facebook was in it for the money? Who would have known they weren't in it for high moral ideals? Who would have known that democracy wasn't at the front of their concerns? And it's always amazing to me that people go, well, you know, corporate America only cares about profit. Yeah, they only care about profit. Congratulations. Ding. The light bulb has finally gone on. The question now is, what are you going to do about it? We know all this stuff. We know that Instagram is horrible for young girls. Higher suicide rate thoughts, worse body image thoughts, all kinds of stuff. Higher rates of eating disorders, all kinds of that. But yet we still gotta have Instagram. It's just nuts. And like I said, I feel for this woman and I give her, you know, credit for coming out and having a conscience. I think she's going to find out very quickly that whistleblower laws don't protect anyone, because we don't, well, how dare you tell the truth? Because we don't want to know the truth. And this is one of those, you know, worst kept secrets. Everybody knows. It's like today, the big news, the Pandora Papers. Rich people are hiding money. Oh my gosh. Really? Rich people are hiding money? Oh my gosh. That's a shocker. You mean like Switzerland? Like everybody knows it's a Swiss bank account. Everyone knows. That's where you go to hide money. Panama? The Bahamas? South Dakota? Oh my gosh. Here in the U.S. we have tax havens too. We have places for shell corporations to hide money for rich people. Yes! This is what rich people do. And it's not just the corporate titans and the captains of industry. It's politicians, it's musicians, it's anybody who's got money trying to avoid paying taxes, trying to avoid educating your children, trying to avoid paving your roads, trying to avoid paying for a healthcare system that takes care of the poor and the elderly, taking money from literally out of children's mouths and out of veterans' backpacks so that they can hoard it for themselves, so they can have a seventh beach house or a 10th island or a giant bathtub boat worth $1 billion or fly a giant phallic rocket into the sky. And oddly enough, that guy didn't have to be in these because he's got a whole team of legal, a whole legal team who hides his money just very well here. Thank you very much. Because they fight for loopholes to make sure that he isn't taxed in the first place. It's really incredible. And then we hear people go, but Rick, we can't afford to invest in roads and bridges and healthcare for kids and homes for veterans. And we just can't get free college for high school kids going into college. Just can't do all that stuff because we're broke. You know why we're broke? You can say it because you already know. Rich people are hoarding the money. Trillions of dollars. I'm not just talking to you a couple of bucks here, shoving a sock under the bed like most people try and do for a rainy day. No, this is, we're talking trillions. And it's not just here in the U.S., it's global. And I spent an entire day falling into this rabbit hole because these 150 journalists, and look, I am not diminishing in any way, shape, or form the work of these heroic journalists who have taken 2 years to go through all of these documents to sift through and find out about Putin's mistress and King Abdullah's money and all of the crazy stuff that's, Tony Blair and the rest of them. Not diminishing that in any way, shape, or form, but we already know this because we knew it back not too long ago when the Panama Papers came out. And they go, oh my gosh, Panama? A tax haven? A place where they set up shell corporations so they can hide money and pass through and not pay anything? Oh my gosh, I can't believe that's true. Yes, you knew it then, and you knew it then, and still did nothing. Nothing. And you go, at what point do you do something other than go to Facebook and be angry about who's using which bathroom? Or, oh my gosh, somebody wants you to wear a mask, and yet... They're robbing you blind, stealing your retirement security, eviscerating your healthcare security, wages stagnant and declining for 40 years, but the mask bridge too far. Holy freaking nuts. So when I say, okay, what are we going to do about it? I get this, because we think the problem is too big. And I had a listener send me this Norman Mailer quote that I found really kind of interesting and fitting. Norman Mailer said on fascism, I really am a pessimist. I've always felt that fascism is a more natural governmental condition than democracy. Democracy is a grace. It's something especially splendid because it's not all routine or automatic. Fascism goes back to our infancy and childhood, where we were always told how to live. We were told, yes, you may do this. No, you may not do that. So the secret of fascism is that it appeals to people whose later lives are not satisfactory. And that part caught me because it's true. These are the folks whose life hasn't been satisfactory. Lots of angry white people who were told if they worked hard, they played by the rules, they'd get ahead, and they didn't because they've been robbed blind by, well, who? The folks who have been hoarding money in tax havens and shelters across shell corporations across this globe. And what do they get in return? They get spoon-fed hatred through their social media platforms to keep them eating each other instead of going after who? That's right. The people who are robbing them freaking blind. And again, it goes back to Jay Gould's, I can pay half the working class to murder the other half, because we're seeing it playing out in Facebook every single day, which is why I've said for years, stay away from it. Don't even engage with it. We put our stuff out to broadcast. If you want to take a look at it, it's fine. It's yours. Take it. But I don't engage. I don't want to be notified by Facebook. I don't need them to tell me what to think or what I should see. I prefer to search it out for myself. I don't need an algorithm to go, gee, Rick's feeling a little low today. Maybe if we send him something, I can get him to feel even worse. And then maybe I can get him to take up a pitchfork and go storm the Capitol for some nitwit in orange. This is the world that we live in. Instead of going who we really should be targeting, the ultra wealthy, we target each other. And then we've got a political party, the Republicans, who keep feeding that, keep feeding the ability to hoard and to hide and to cheat and to steal from the tax code because they hate taxes. They hate government. And then you got a Democratic Party that isn't much better because they're fighting over, well, who knows what at this point. The firing squad is certainly circular. When all the American people want an opportunity. All we want are good schools for our kids, safe neighborhoods, opportunity, health care when we get sick, retirement security so when we get old we have some dignity and respect left. It's not that difficult. This isn't that hard. This is the richest country in the history of civilization. The globe is at its wealthiest moment ever. And yet we have mass suffering and poverty and greed like you cannot believe. All because the people who have control, they don't want to share. And they're really good at dividing us. In fact, so good that we divide ourselves for them. They don't even have to pay us. This is the mastery of Jay Gould's. I could pay half the working class to murder the other half. He doesn't even have to pay anymore. We're paying for him. By taking up Facebook, by taking the social media and attacking each other. And more importantly, not looking at where the real criminals are. Not looking at where the real pain and the hatred should be focused. Which is at these people who have been cheating us for generations. And the thing is these stories come out every couple of years. And we're flooded with it. Because then we're overwhelmed and everything else goes aside. And then it goes away. And trust me, in 6 months, nobody's going to remember the Pandora Papers. They're going to think, the Pandora on the radio? And it will be forgotten until the next time and the next time. The question is when do we say enough? When do we force politicians to go, it ends now? That's my question. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are you fed up with it yet? I know I certainly am. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day Londoners referred to as the Battle of Cable Street. By some accounts, as many as 250,000 trade unionists, radicals, and anti-fascist fighters joined together to protest Sir Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. The fascists planned to march in black shirt uniform through London's then heavily Irish and Jewish working class East End neighborhood. Mosley's BUF scapegoated Jews for the economic crisis brought on by the Great Depression. He had drawn thousands to rallies in previous years, and now looked to impose fascist dominance over the most vulnerable of Londoners. Bill Fishman, a Jewish activist and son of an immigrant tailor, who was there on that day, recollected, quote, "I was moved to see the bearded Jews and Irish Catholic dockers standing up to stop Mosley. I shall never forget that as long as I live. How working class people could get together to oppose the evil of fascism." The Metropolitan Police stationed as many as 10,000 policemen to keep counter-protesters from directly confronting the BUF. But the anti-fascists physically blocked every possible path into the East End. They constructed barricades along Cable Street made from paving stones and household furniture. Women emptied garbage bags and chamber pots from windows onto the fascists. Marbles were thrown in the direction of the fascists and their protectors. Seamen pulled out their lorries and turned them on their sides. Tram drivers parked and abandoned their streetcars in the middle of the street to prevent the fascists from continuing their march. Protesters chanted the slogan of the Spanish Civil War, "No pasarán," or "They shall not pass." And that day, the fascists did not pass. They were stopped by the power of working people. Here at the Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. That's because we're not sellouts. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I'm looking at, you know, where we are, all of the stories, the Facebook, the Pandora Papers, the fact that we're still not any closer to getting a infrastructure bill passed through. And it's all just drowning out the fact that we're being robbed constantly. And the sad reality is, like I said, I believe that eventually this will pass. We'll forget about it. We'll go on to something else to be angry and frustrated about. And we're still not getting anything on the infrastructure front. I'm here to share some thoughts of all of the craziness that we find ourselves in and just how strange things have gotten. I've asked John Nichols to come talk with us. John is the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's also the author of The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's great to be with you.
So I'm looking at the top stories of the day, Facebook, hate book, we might as well call it that. And hey, guess what? Rich people are hoarding their money. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, you know, in a weird kind of way, it's like, the sun came up today, and it's another day. But I think that some of what we're getting here is important. And if we use history as a measure, we know that at times in the past where we have had revelations about just how crooked our wealthy are, our rich people are, that has made it easier to tax them, and it's made it easier to investigate them and to go after them. And so I think I see this moment as an opportunity. We are being given information that we should act upon, and the action that we take is very logical. As regards to Pandora revelation, we should be doing what President Biden and, frankly, some Democrats in the Senate, Bernie Sanders and others, have proposed, which is to beef up that section of the IRS that goes after the very rich. And we know that when you put IRS forensic investigators on the task, one bureaucrat, for lack of a better term, hired at a very small amount of money can bring in tens of millions of dollars simply by following the trails and figuring out how the rich don't pay their taxes. If we set up an operation that was aimed at going after all of these offshoring schemes, after all of the efforts by which very wealthy Americans hide their money, and especially if we did that in cooperation with other countries that have already begun this process, the Germans in particular, there's potential to find hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, there is. There is, John. There's potential. And I seem to remember this kind of like deja vu all over again, because when the Panama Papers dropped, I remember going, hey, we should be doing this then. And every time these revelations come out that there's a Switzerland around every corner where rich people are hoarding their money, we have this moment of, hey, we should do something. And then it fades away.
Well, you're right. Although I will note that when the Panama Papers came out, there were different people in charge. And so there, you know, we always hold out the possibility or the hope that those who are in charge at this point will be more responsible than those who were in charge in the past. And, you know, I can't guarantee that. I mean, I wish I could. I wish I could tell you, you know, this is going to be the time where it all comes together and we're going to really have a revelation and we do the right thing. That's not guaranteed. That's about us. To some extent, it's what we demand. And You know, I think you were hinting at this before in your introduction, that at a certain point, if those in power, now Democrats, do not crack down on some of this, at some point it is going to blow up on us, right?
It has to. I mean, because look, you already have people, John, are saying there's no difference between the two parties. They're both the corporate parties. They're both in bed with the moneyed interests. This is an opportunity for Democrats to step aside from that and say, look, we're really in a bold way going to go and crack down on this and bring revenue back into this country so that we can do all the things we want to do in this Build Back Better plan, so we can put Sinema and Manchin to rest. And we can really invest in the country and do the things that we need to do and hold people accountable.
Well, that is what I hope for. And I have to tell you, look, if we're honest with ourselves, we will realize that, you know, we're actually in a period of critical junctures right now. And we're frankly being tested. It's as simple as that. And the test is this. Are we prepared to govern, first and foremost? And I don't mean you and me, I mean those we've elected. Are they prepared to actually govern? Governing isn't about, you know, avoiding the issues that arise or papering over them or, you know, kind of finding some middle ground that makes everybody sort of happy but doesn't really deal with the issues. Governing is about seizing the power you've been given and doing things with it.
Yep.
Now, our great leaders, the ones who stand out, Lincoln, Roosevelt, and dare I say, although I disagreed with them on most issues, Ronald Reagan. You know, when they got power, they did things with it. They did big transformational things. They changed the direction of the country. Now, Joe Biden has not been dealt the easiest hand. He doesn't have huge majorities in the House and the Senate. But I'll remind you that some of our most dramatic leaders didn't have huge majorities, throughout our history. You work with what you've got. If you've got the power to do things, you do it. And in this case, what Biden has to do, and it comes down to him in a very large extent, he's got to find his inner LBJ, not his inner FDR, although I'd love it if he did some fireside chats and a little more communicating about this. He's got to find his inner LBJ, and that means he's got to recognize that it is his job as both President of the United States and leader of the Democratic Party to make the Congress, that is a Democratic House, Democratic Senate, do the things that are necessary.
He's got to get in there and start twisting some arms.
That's right. That's a twisting arms and naming names. Going out there and finding the people who are the roadblocks. And we know we can name them right now. It's not hard. Sinema, Manchin, number of the folks in the House. And talking to them about, you know, the damage that they're doing. I'll give you an example. I don't necessarily think that Biden has gone on TV and say, boy, I hate Joe Manchin, or boy, Kyrsten Sinema is the worst person in the world. No, what he needs to go on TV and do is say, I'm here in Tucson, Arizona, and I want to talk to you about what the reconciliation bill can do for Arizona.
Exactly. They need to sell it.
Yeah. And
because
it,
I said this the other day. We're talking about numbers. We're talking about $6 trillion. We're talking about $3.5 trillion. Manchin's got $1.5 trillion. Biden came out with $2 trillion. Now we're talking about $2.1 trillion. We're talking about numbers. We're not talking about the things that this investment is going to do to make people's lives better. Nobody's selling that stuff. And I want to know exactly how you're going to make my life better and our listeners' lives better. That's the important stuff. He's got to get out on the stump.
You're so right. And you know, this is an interesting thing. I've got a piece coming up on The Nation in a couple of days where I went back. Now, look at the history. Not on theory, not, you know, oh, I think this might have happened, but actually went back through the records. You know, when Roosevelt was selling Social Security, he was doing fireside chats one after another. He was doing speeches. He was using every medium of communication he had to communicate about the importance of what was involved in Social Security. He did the same with the Works Progress Administration, with other big initiatives of his presidency. When Lyndon Johnson assumed the presidency after the assassination of John Kennedy, he did an address to the nation, address to the joint session of Congress and to the nation, and he went into detail about carrying forward And much of what he talked about there was Medicare and Medicaid. You know, and he went into specifics on what he wanted to accomplish. When Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he did an address to the nation about the Civil Rights Act and about the voting rights stuff that was going to have to be done. And so what we understand is that historically, presidents who wanted to accomplish something, yeah, they did the backroom, you know, negotiations and maybe some twisting arms and things like that. That's important. But they also went to the American people and said, this is what it's about. This is what's at stake. This is what we're trying to accomplish. And I don't think I haven't seen enough of that from Biden at this point.
And I haven't seen enough, not just from Biden, but from the party as a whole.
Yeah, I
mean,
agree with you.
The party as a whole is already, you know, they've divided themselves up into camps and have allowed themselves to be divided up into camps. By Republicans who are saying, oh, this is just the far left's, you know, it's their wet dream wish list. And no, it's about getting college education for kids to get a community college degree, an associate's degree. It's about early, you know, childhood education. It's about getting granny some hearing aids and some glasses and some teeth.
Yeah.
It's about a lot of things that are going to make a lot of people's lives better. Right. It's not a wet dream wish list by the far extreme left.
No, not at all. In fact, quite the opposite. This is basically what Joe Biden ran on, and Joe Biden was not the left's choice. But more importantly, this is one thing I would suggest. Don't do what Bill Clinton did. And Bill Clinton would give these marathon speeches, sometimes an hour and a half, and he'd kind of list everything. It was the laundry list, right? I would rather see Biden do a series of relatively short addresses to the American people where he spoke about specific components of this bill.
Yep.
And like, think about the caregiving component. I mean, I don't know what your family status is. I know you reasonably well, but you know, I don't know if you've got elderly parents or disabled people in your family or, you know, folks that need care or maybe even thinking, you know, about some point down the line where you're going to need care. But at some point in most of our lives, almost everybody in America's life, we intersect with the caregiving demand. We have a parent who, you know, maybe they're at home still, but they can't quite take care of themselves as much as they need to or as much as they used to. Maybe they can stay at home if they get the care that they need. Maybe they'll go into a quality facility in their community. Same with people with disabilities. And right now, when that reality confronts somebody, it's a jarring reality because most people don't have the resources. They don't have the structures in place to make it happen. This $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill has within it or has been discussed. You know, they're still sorting out elements of it. A caregiving component that could radically transform that for every family in America. If Joe Biden took 20 minutes to talk to America about that, in real detail, with real people, maybe even using whiteboards like Robert Reich does sometimes and things like that.
Bring out the flip charts from Ross Perot.
Right. That's it, right. I think it could have a profound impact. And, you know, do I think that the TV networks, which are, you know, just commercial operations, are they going to give him, you know, free airtime every night to talk about this? Maybe not. I think they should, you know, it's reasonable that they would give him time for an address to the nation, you know, kind of a scene setter. But then, you know, the Democratic Party, they're raising money all the time.
Yeah, but you don't need it in this day and age, John.
No,
with social media, we're the TikTok generation. It doesn't even need to be 20 minutes. You need two minutes. You need good explainers to go.
Maybe, I got a better idea now. Maybe he just goes on your show.
There you go. I've been trying for a year to get him to come on.
Give him an hour. Give him a little time. But you understand, he can go to all sorts of different platforms and do it. You're right. You're absolutely right. Although, I still think the televised address to the nation has some power and some historical heft. Bottom line is, what you and I are doing right now, what your listeners are hearing us kind of sort through right now, is the calculus. This is what ought to be happening in D.C. Instead of, you know, waiting. Oh, you know, did we get a little bit more movement from Sinema there? Did Manchin? Did he say something that maybe we can work with? Did Josh Gottheimer say something that might be, is there some indication? You know, maybe at a certain point, you just say, look, we're going to continue the negotiations. That's cool. but we're not going to just do it behind closed doors anymore. Now we're going to go out in public. We're going to talk about this stuff. Yep. We're going to talk about what needs to be done.
And you've got to expose the people holding this up, because ultimately, Cinema and Manchin, and Manchin, you know, in particular in West Virginia, which one of the poorest states in the country, and people I know who live there desperately need the investment and the safety net, because I've been saying this is almost a small reset of the last 40 years of Reaganomics that has, you know, just destroyed, eviscerated a social safety net that generations past once had. So for me, this is about, you know, kind of reshoring some of that up for future generations. And it's kind of our legacy going forward, John.
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, here's the deal. This country throughout its history has had fits and starts. We've done a lot of things wrong, but we've done a lot of things right. And the unfortunate reality is that sometimes we do something quite good, and then we take two steps back. You know, you've got a lot of what FDR did, what LBJ did, to some extent the presidents after them, and then you get Reagan, he pulls us back a ways, and then, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is that each generation has a responsibility to fight as hard as it can, to accomplish as much as it can. And we're in a point right now where the polling data suggests that the American people are absolutely ready, 100% ready, for an expansion of Medicare, for paid family and medical leave, for free community colleges, even more than that, to be quite honest, for caregiving, for child credit, for a climate core to deal with, create jobs and deal with, you know, the climate crisis. The fact is, the polling is fantastic on this stuff, and the Democrats have control of the House and the Senate and the presidency. Put those two pieces together. It's not complicated. It doesn't happen that often. Where the people are ready, where you've got the power, you know, this is the point at which to close the deal. And if you've got a couple Democrats that get in the way, clearly you do, you know, you do what you have to. I can tell you, I'm a historian of these things. Lyndon Johnson brought Southern senators in, and he said, you know, you're going to vote for something, and you're not going to like it, but you're going to have to do it. And he got enough of them to do what needed to be done that he, you know, like him or hate him.
He got it across the goalpost.
He got a hell of a lot of stuff done, including things that people were resistant to.
So let me ask you a last question I've got for you then, because this infrastructure bill, my fear from the very beginning is we were going to end up right where we are and we're going to get nothing. How do you see this playing out now that we've extended the deadline potentially to the end of October with some more wrangling? Do you see at the end of October things getting done?
We get the infrastructure bill one way or the other. It's going to come. That'll happen. It's at the end of the day we get.
All right. I love your optimism.
Well, it's not total optimism, my friend. It's that I think it's because people know that at the end of the day we get the infrastructure bill that it's being held up, because people know that once it goes across the line, then it's going to be harder to get something else, right?
Yep.
And we need the something else.
All right, good stuff. That's where we're going to leave it then. Okay. John, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff, my friend.
It's a pleasure to be with you, my friend. Stay strong. Keep doing what you do.
Thanks so much, our good friend John Nichols. Take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the evening that a series of explosions began at the T.A. Gillespie Company near Morgan, New Jersey. The explosions would destroy the plant and 300 buildings and kill an estimated 100 people. The world was embroiled in World War I. The United States had entered the global conflict the year before. The nation's factories were churning out munitions and other supplies for the war effort. On that fateful evening at Gillespie, workers were loading shells at the sprawling complex of 700 buildings that covered more than 2,000 acres. The initial explosion was likely an accident.
Regardless, the explosion was so severe that it cut water lines to that part of the plant. Without water pressure, firefighters struggled to douse the flames. A chain reaction of explosions touched off as the fire spread in the plant. Houses in the nearby town shook from the massive explosions. Windows exploded and residents fled. Residents from three towns were evacuated due to the disaster. The New York Sun described the exodus as, quote, streams of human misery, mothers and fathers, frightened children clutching still more frightened dogs, old people tottering along with all the same dazed expressions on their faces, as if they scarcely realized what had happened. When the fire was finally put out, nearly half of the plant's buildings were destroyed. It was impossible to say exactly how many workers were killed, so bad was the carnage. Two members of the U.S. Coast Guard died responding to the disaster. The disaster was then compounded when a flu epidemic swept through the residents evacuated from nearby towns. The death toll and misery from these tragic events mounted even higher.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said, the sad reality is, you know, Democrats are failing to lead in this moment. And looking for the Republicans to bail them out? I think it's a fool's errand, to be honest. This idea that Republicans need to get out of the way. No, you need to push them out of the way. If they're going to be the obstructionists, you got to get them out of the way. You can't wish and hope. It's not going to happen. You got to mobilize and act. That simple. And sadly, we're just not seeing the mobilization and the acting. We're seeing a lot of finger pointing, a lot of waving, but not a lot of pointy elbows. As my eighth grade basketball coach always said, God gave basketball players elbows for a reason. You put them out there, and so when someone gets an elbow in the chops, they never go back after the ball like that again. And it's the same thing that Democrats better figure out. And they better figure it out quick. And here to share some thoughts on, well, where we are after a day off from Facebook and all of the other craziness that came out today, I've asked our good friend Jeff Hauser to come talk with us. Jeff is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project there at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The result, revolvingdoorproject.org is their website. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
I love to be here.
So a day off from Facebook. Was it a good day? Did you miss anything?
I actually spent more time thinking about Facebook today than normally. I mean, I think about them as a corporation whose influence in Washington must be fought tooth and nail. But as we were kind of discussing a little bit right before we went on live, I don't go to Facebook much anymore. Honestly, actually, since they went to the algorithm, which is like 12 years ago, but instead of, you know, just giving me a random sampling of what my actual friends are saying, they give me the stuff that they creepily predict I want to see, and it just doesn't work for me. Like, that's not how my brain thinks. They, for better or for worse, they don't actually understand my brain, which, you know, maybe that's to their credit, but I don't really like Facebook. But obviously, the big story, the big public policy implication of Facebook being down is also WhatsApp was down and Instagram was down. And WhatsApp and Instagram are two distinct brands, but they are companies that were purchased a decade ago by Facebook because they saw incipient competition and they decided we are going to take out our competition before the competition takes us out. And so when Facebook goes down, it brings down their ostensible competitors as well, because they're not really competitors. They're the same company. And so ironically, just as the Facebook was responding to the Federal Trade Commission's lawsuit in court today, their reality was proving that they are a vastly too large company that needs to be broken up.
Yeah. Do you think that was by design? Do you think that something nefarious happened? Or is it just, you know, the fate of the gods and the moons aligning and all of that stuff?
I don't know. I know there are lots of different theories out there. Obviously, there is a whistleblower who appeared on 60 Minutes last night after having provided a wealth of material to the Wall Street Journal in the last couple of weeks. And there's obviously dissatisfaction within Facebook about that the company is not what they signed up for. Facebook hires a lot of talented people. They're not talented at all things, and they shouldn't be running the world, but they are like getting to choose some really talented people. And I think some of those people are beginning to seriously regret the decisions that they made to go work at Facebook. And I think that internal threat to Facebook is very real, just like renewed antitrust enforcement would also be a very real threat.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, Jeff, and, you know, I remember a couple, it's been several months back now, where there was a push to get Facebook and Google on the UN. And you go, why do we want private corporations on the UN? Because they do such a nice job of democracy, right?
Yeah, I mean, they are, there was a piece I read in The Atlantic recently that compared Facebook to basically being like a country, and it views itself that way increasingly. They've hired people to be an oversight board, kind of like a judicial Supreme Court for Facebook. They're a very weird entity, and I'd like them, to the extent to which I want them to exist at all, or they are forced to, I'd like them to be a run-of-the-mill corporation, maybe different in that maybe they should actually pay taxes, which so many corporations don't. But I'd like them to just be ground down to size and not be a behemoth astride the planet. They should just listen to the rules like everyone else, which is not Mark Zuckerberg's inclination, but I think it should be ours.
No, I'm right there with you. And, you know, for me, the whole idea of, you know, most people don't realize there's this algorithm that pushes them content that Facebook wants them to see. And, you know, maybe not stuff that's indicative of what their friends are saying. Because at the beginning, if I remember right, it was just a timeline. When someone would post something, it would go up and you would scroll through and you go, hey, you know, 2 hours ago, someone said this. 4 hours ago, someone said this. It was just a kind of a running thing. Instead, now I keep getting, you keep getting hit with the same kind of things that you go, I don't want any of this. And I don't know. I keep going, I don't know who is reading my mind, but I'll have Googled something and all of a sudden, well, that's odd. That's there too.
Yeah. I mean, so Google and Facebook, through a variety of mechanisms, are basically tracking you almost everywhere you are on the internet, unless you go to considerable lengths, which you can look up some of the things. I haven't done actually all of the ones I should probably, but unless you go to pretty significant lengths on the internet, you are being tracked. You're being surveyed in like in a surveillance sense. And some people are like, well, it doesn't really matter. These are corporations, not the government. But I kind of think Google and Facebook are powerful enough that them conducting surveillance on people is really not any better than it being done by the government. So yeah, they know, they think they know you. Their algorithm, which is not an artificial intelligence of its own, it's designed by people and constantly tinkered with by human engineers, that is guiding decisions. And it's not a great system, but it is a system that allows them to hire very few human beings and run a very large company. And they think it maximizes the amount of time on their site, which they can then monetize.
Yep.
And it's crazy. And
That was the big headline, though, wasn't it, Jeff? That this whistleblower came out and said, gee, you know, they're not so much concerned about you know, all of those high-minded things. It's about the money. Oh, gee, it's a corporation pursuing its own profitable interests. Shock of shocks.
Yeah, I mean, what I think has happened with Silicon Valley is interesting in that there was so much venture capital money to support incipient corporations that it was more important to companies for their first several years of existence, for longer than any other time in history, to build scale without building growth and profits. So they actually really were not worried about making money. They often lost money. But because they convinced investors that they would eventually build a monopoly that they would be able to turn into money, they basically just needed to grow. They didn't need to make money. Remember, like companies like Uber still do not make money. Amazon has only recently become profitable. It mostly was a break-even operation for a very long time, even as it was ascending to levels of, you know, $1.5-2 trillion. So in this environment in which the capital markets are willing to invest in the future profits without seeing current profits, Silicon Valley decided to compete for the most talented people in the world. And the most talented people in the world, one of the ways to convince them to come work for you, and again, this is talent in a very narrow sense. I'm not like saying these are the best people or anything, but the narrow sense of talent that they were competing for, they had to use all this rhetoric about how they were going to make the world a better place, because that was necessary to attract the type of people who could help them build this massive, giant, too large corporation, which is like destroying the world now. And I think some of the people have like continued to drink the Kool-Aid, and other people who work there are really dissatisfied because they bought into it. They really thought that they were going to a company that was very different than like a Goldman Sachs. For a while, Silicon Valley was competing with Wall Street for academically gifted people and winning. And they were doing it by saying, we're kinder and gentler. And honestly, I think at this point in time, you can make a real argument that Facebook is a greater threat to the world than Goldman Sachs, which I do not say out of any affinity for Goldman Sachs.
No, no, I know that, and I agree with you, because both are just as bad. Because I look at the other side of this, you've got, you know, the kind of monopoly that Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and all that has, and then you look at the other side of Wall Street and the kind of monopoly that they've got, and now we see these Pandora Papers of the uber wealthy across the globe stashing money all over the place and have been doing it for decades. And, you know, I said, look, you know, every couple of years we see this come up where we wake up to the reality that rich people are robbing us blind, and we get upset with it for about 6 minutes, and then it goes away. Why is this going to be any different? Why is this moment going to be any different? Or do you think it will be?
I mean, I think the key thing to always remember is that we as a people, broadly speaking, have agency. So I don't think it's predetermined. Obviously, if you're a betting person, and you're looking at the last, you know, couple of decades, every time there is a reason to be outraged at rich people and there isn't much of a response or an adequate response, you could come away thinking that we're all doomed to repeat it in the future. And that's definitely possible. I'd like to think that we have agency. Like, that's kind of what we do at Revolving Door Project, is try to think about a source of potential fixes, that is the powers that exist within the executive branch of the government. We're not talking about passing new laws, but enforcing old laws. We like to think that if you did that better, you could make the world less unfair. And so that if you think about this in the context of the Pandora Papers and how rich people evade taxes and other laws, there are some new laws that would need to be written, but there are other bad laws that would need to be enforced better. We would need to allocate more people in the government to the task of white-collar criminal enforcement. I mean, white-collar crime is a massive problem in this country. It is economically expensive in the sense of taxes. It is physically expensive in the sense of people dying prematurely, be it due to workplace safety issues or environmental issues. It's, you know, the fact is, when we have laws, it's better. Like, honestly, Goldman is not quite as bad, because Dodd-Frank, as weak as it is, as many times as it's been weakened legislatively or by Jerome Powell at the Fed, we do have like some laws, and they're somewhat being enforced, and there's some positive signs on some of Biden's regulatory picks. So we have some rules. Right now on Facebook, we have no rules. So that's why they're particularly dangerous. But there are a lot of laws on the books that the Justice Department could be applying, that the Internal Revenue Service could be applying, the rest of the Treasury Department could be going after, the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the more we enforce these laws, the more we bring rich people into compliance with the law, the better off we will be. And it's also can be a virtuous cycle. Not everything has to always get worse. The more we make rich people follow the law, the easier it is to get the next rich person to follow the law. And they're like, you know, I don't want to take that risk. I'm only worth $300 million, you know? It might be okay. I might not have to do this sleazy thing, which can get me to $600 million. And so we can make change, but we have to pay attention and apply political pressure all year.
And this is where I think, you know, Biden talking about, you know, investing more money in the IRS to go after these tax cheats, no matter where they are. Because ultimately, the reality is by them getting to cheat us out of taxes. That means our kids don't get the kind of education they deserve. We don't get to invest in early childhood education or you know, college or vocational education. On the other end, we don't get to get expand Medicare. We don't get to do all of the things that we need to do, infrastructure, human infrastructure stuff. We don't get to do any of that stuff because, well, you've got these cheaters among us who are hoarding, and we seem to be okay with it. And this is where my frustration is, because this ain't new. We've been talking about this stuff for decades now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a genuine culture of corruption among elites in this country because they've gotten away with it. And if your strategy works over time, it's like if you watch sports, you know, in basketball, they're now going to try to cut down this year on some gimmicky plays where people like kind of induce fouls by the defense, where it's a really artificial, obvious move. But until you actually crack down, players like James Harden and Trae Young are going to do things that just don't look natural because that's the incentive structure. And so the only way to change the behavior of rich people is to give them a reason to change. They need to feel threatened. They need to feel like they have to follow the law.
Yeah, we got to keep the pitchfork near the door. Or as my friend Rich Ojeda says, we need to eat just one of them.
Yes, that would be a good idea.
Because ultimately, we need the investment. Because look, right now we're bickering over numbers. Nobody knows what's in this Build Back Better plan because we're still talking about numbers. We're fighting over numbers, and nobody goes 6, 3.5, 1.5, 1, no, 2, 2.1. Sounds like an auction, and still nobody knows what's in this damn thing.
Right, because the goal of the bill isn't to spend money. The goal of the bill is to address massive problems in this country, be it, you know, the lack of affordable child care to, you know, the climate change. And yeah, there's been a complete failure of messaging because there's been kind of a politicoization of the discourse where it's all about ups and downs and Senate process rather than who's for good, who's for bad, who are you fighting for? And that's definitely something the Democrats...
That's an excellent point, Jeff. An excellent point, because the Democrats are fighting over numbers and academic stuff, as Republicans always fight over narrative, the good and the bad. I like how you put that, because I think this is where Democrats need to take a page out of their playbook and talk about narratives, talk about how this bill is going to make people's lives better and get their behinds out on the road and sell this thing in a way that's going to force Manchin and Sinema and the rest of them on board. Start twisting some arms if you have to.
Yeah, absolutely. And they should be talking not about how this will or will not help in the midterm elections. They should talk about how it's going to help people. I think people can make the connection to the political case, but that is not the job of politicians. Too often sound like pundits rather than people trying to lead the country in a better direction.
No, you're absolutely right. It's one of those things where, you know, we know that if people are feeling the economy is doing well, people are feeling confident, they're going to stick with the incumbent. But if you've got nothing to say, hey, look, this is how we made your life better. It is going to be a very, very interesting year next year. So last question I've got for you, because as we are bickering over these numbers, as someone like Manchin steps on the back of his boat and lectures about how we just can't possibly afford it, do you see it getting through?
I think something will happen. I mean, honestly, I'm more concerned about Sinema. I think Manchin's the opposite of a policy wonk. I don't think he has well-reasoned, well-thought-out ideas. I think there's various corrupt aspects of his life. But deep down, I actually kind of think he wants Biden to succeed. And like, it is admittedly true that he is representing a state that is a very difficult state for the Democrats to win. And we can talk about the reasons why. But at this point in time, it is true. The Sinema thing is just so scary.
So bizarre.
I just don't know if she's running for re-election, despite being, you know, a generation younger than Manchin. And I just worry that if she like wants to live a life of vineyards, Fox News, and the occasional lobbying gig, I'm worried about Sinema.
That's a good place to end it. Jeff, I appreciate the time as always. Great stuff, my friend.
Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Jeff Hauser, Executive Director of the Revolving Door Project there at the Center for Economic Policy Research. Check out their website, therevolvingdoorproject.org. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Here at the Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.